welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ, and I am your host for this week's a Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates missed the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Now, today, though, I have a very special guest who has come on, and I'd like to introduce you to Mary Johnson, who is in her second year of her PhD in English Language and Literature under the supervision of Dr. Brooke Cameron. Welcome to Grad Chat, Mary.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm actually very excited to have Mary on. And first of all, I must congratulate you on the release of your first children's book. Or the launch of it, really, and I think it's fascinating. And it was called The Curse of Eelgrass Bog. And I do want to talk to you about your book a bit later, after we've talked about your research, but I just wanted to get in there. Well done on doing that. Something a little bit different than doing your research, but I'm sure you've got lots of good stories to tell about that project, I guess, and then what happens next with other books and things. So well done on that. So, but before we do talk about your research, can you give us a bit of a background of how you came to do your PhD at Queen's? And what's the fascination for English literature for you?
Gosh, I mean, I think I've always loved stories. So for me, doing English was always just what I was going to have to do in high school. I loved English the most. And I think part of it was that I moved around a lot as a kid, and the books and the stories were the one things that I could take with me. They were very portable.
Right.
So I did that in high school, loved it. Then I did my undergrad in English and creative writing at the University of Victoria. Didn't have enough school, so I went to my MPhil in children's literature, specifically at the University of Cambridge in England.
Lovely.
Because they had a children's literature program, which was fantastic.
Which is brilliant, because not many places do.
No, especially not in Canada, unfortunately. But luckily, Queen's had some cool people in their department that were interested in children's literature and a lot of other things that I was interested in as well. So I ended up coming to Queen's. Never lived in Kingston before, never been to Kingston before, but...
So you were only in Cambridge for a couple of years then for your MPhil, or was it 1 year?
It was a one-year program, but I was actually born around that, so right. That kind of made it feel a bit more familiar, I suppose.
Oh, I guess you got lots of rallies over there then too.
Yes, that did help.
Which does help a lot. I always take my hat off to students who have travelled a little bit, and particularly going away from home. But I guess Canada's your home too.
Absolutely. You know, I'm lucky to have two.
Yeah. I've got three. Canada, Australia, England, yeah, I'll keep counting. Okay, so let's talk about your research. And I know you're only in your second year, so, you know, you're not really full-fledgling into it. I mean, you're just starting it, but you've got a pretty good idea of what you want to do. And your research topic is Eco-Critical Approaches to Children's Literature, which is a fascinating title in itself. What made you choose that title? And perhaps you can give us a bit of an overview of what you are trying to do for your PhD.
Yeah, no, I mean, eco-criticism is something that I didn't really know a whole lot about either before joining this program, but there's quite a lot of people in the department who do it. So that's kind of what fed my interest. But, you know, eco-criticism, I think it's so important now because you're looking at the environment and you're looking at it from a very multidisciplinary angle. So you've got, you know, your climate studies, science studies, but also literature that's featured around nature. And to me, that just went hand in hand with children's books and children's studies so well, because I don't think you can talk about things like climate anxiety without also talking about what it means to be a kid right now.
Right, right. So it all got based from that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's so many stories that tackle that. So there's just so much to do, and it feels still very new and fresh, which is great.
I think we underestimate the value of, as you said, children's books. Because you even think of nursery rhymes and things that we sing as a kid. There's so much meaning behind them, which we don't always think about at the time. But there are meanings behind them. You know, was it ring a ring of roses, a pocket full of posies, a tissue, we all don't. That's about the Black Death and things. Mm. But you don't really think about that at the time until you start going back and re-evaluating. What is this author trying to accomplish here? Is it just a good, fun story for a kid to get their teeth around, or were we trying to send them a message?
Exactly. And I think sometimes the answer is both, which makes it even more complicated. Yeah. But
I guess with some of the English literature too, and I've said this to some of the other students in English Lit, do you ever have a chance to read a novel and actually enjoy it just for the novel's sake, or you were always analysing it? what is the hidden meaning in this book today?
It's definitely a hard brain to switch off, I think. But I'm quite lucky in that my academic research is very 19th century, early 20th century. Okay. And then when I like to read, I'm reading more contemporary stuff. So I think that provides something of a buffer.
Right.
But I think the voice is always going to be there.
Yeah. I don't think I can read a book the same way anymore.
Exactly.
So you're interested in exploring the intersections of girlhood and wild spaces in the golden age, Queen Victoria times, of children's literature. So what does all that mean? Because, you know, intersections of girlhood and wild space. Okay, so what's a wild space? What do you mean by wild spaces?
Well, it's one of these things I think that makes people frustrated with English, because it sounds like it should be simple, but quite a lot of what we're trying to do is define what does that mean. Because I think quite literally it can just be a space that is wild, a space that is outside of civilization and the rules are slightly different. But I think it's also a place where people can be wild. And I think especially as a kid, you know, you're outside of adult control.
You can let your imagination
exactly
run.
Yeah, you're a little bit feral, like, you know, you just exactly. So I think wild spaces can be so many different things, and I really like thinking about them in the context of childhood studies, and not just, you know, a wild wood, but
right,
what does it mean to be wild in this place?
What does it mean to be free of, to think of anything?
Exactly.
Without, like you said, without the restrictions of rules and regulations.
For sure.
Why the Golden Age? Why 1865 to 1926? What's the fascination with that period?
I think there's a really interesting shift that kind of happens there. And that, I mean, I know the Golden Age of children's literature is very debated, as most things are. But that one, it sort of starts with Alice in Wonderland, which is really where you see this turn away from children's literature being very, very didactic and very to teach you something, to becoming a little stranger, a little more fun. Genre fiction starts really taking off. And then it ends sort of around Winnie the Pooh, 1926, around there.
Okay, right.
So, and I think both of those stories you can look at when you're thinking about things like wild spaces and nature and eco-criticism and girlhood as well. So for me, that was just a really fascinating period because it was books that I grew up reading, I found very beloved, but there's also a lot happening there that we haven't heard of that have just sort of slipped away out of print and memory as well.
Yeah, so it's easy to remember the easier parts, like particularly both those books that you mentioned.
Yes.
They've been made into movies and things. So I think the hard thing about that, if you've read the book, you have your own image, then you see a movie and you go, oh, it's not quite how I thought it was going to be.
Well, no, I mean, Alice in Wonderland, Winnie the Pooh, people just think, oh, yes, the Disney version.
Exactly, and there's a lot more to it, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about girls, girlhood, or you're looking at girlhood, but then you've got in here things about looking at the pressures of food and behaviour. Are you looking at this in terms of, as we know, some girls get themselves into eating disorders and things? And are you looking at how the literature is showcasing that? What are you trying to do there, looking at the girlhood part and food in particular?
I think it's interesting to me because a lot of the language that we have around things like disordered eating, that, mm-hmm, you know, they weren't talking about that in the 19th century. But for my special topics, I'm looking specifically at things like adventure stories and shipwreck stories where you end up, you know, stranded on an island. And
oh,
you have
so you've got to survive.
You do. And it's interesting because I think it just brings attention to things like body and food and how much, you know, how little you're eating and just this hyper awareness. So I'm just sort of interested in how these stories that were also traditionally for boys, how they influence girls differently and how girls react in these situations compared to boys. And is there a difference? And, you know, what sort of things get brought into the light there?
Can you give some examples from some books where it shows the two differences?
Yeah.
Is it easy to do, or do you have to try and pull it out?
I think they're less common. So you've got the boys' ones would be things like Coral Island and Treasure Island and
right,
all of those.
Mm-hmm.
But then you've got 1839, there's Layla, by Anne Fraser Tytlow, which is about a girl who gets shipwrecked. But she's also got her dad and her nurse, and they build a sweet little house, and there's grapes and domestic goats, and it's very easy.
Right.
So it's more about her learning to not become wild and to keep her Englishness and her good girl on this island, whereas the boy stories, they kind of embrace it a bit more.
Yeah, and they go feral.
They do go feral, and it's yeah, and they're like, good for them, you know.
Is it hard to find those sorts of books though?
It is a bit, yeah. No, you do have to wade through the archives a bit, and there definitely aren't many where you'd say it's like a girl-centric adventure story, especially if it's a shipwreck story, mm-hmm. Sort of like the female Robinson Crusoe type.
So what do you look up when you go to the library and say, do you guys have any books on this topic from this period of time? Is it as simple as that, or do you have to go into more depth or give them more tags to look up?
I think it's, I mean, the one benefit of there not being many is that the ones that there are, people are aware of.
Right.
So if you go down the literature, there'll just be a reference, and sometimes it's literally just a line about this one book, and then you have to try and find it, and it's out of print, and it's a bit of a detective show in that way.
Can you do most of it online to find them, or do you have to actually go to certain archives?
Most of it I've been able to do online. That's one good. Was out of print. I did have to go to the archive here at Queen's, but luckily they actually had a copy of it.
That was good.
So that was lucky.
Yeah. So your original topic, eco-critical approaches to children's literature, how easy is it to connect eco-critical theory with childhood studies and, say, disability studies? Now, what sort of literature are you looking for there? I mean, you talked about finding the girls who shipwrecked, but it's very, very different. How easy is it to connect that eco-critical theory with those other topics?
I would say, I mean, I wouldn't ever call it easy, but I think there is still a lot of discussion happening. And normally, you know, there are people who are talking about two of the three or something like that, because I think a lot of anxiety around, you know, being in nature, being a girl, food studies, disability studies, and, you know, what we consume and all of this, it's all very, very interconnected. So there are a lot of people addressing it from a lot of different angles. So far, I've not felt like completely out of sea in that way.
Is this? I don't remember reading books as a kid, and the teachers, you know, how the teachers give you books to read, and then the teacher, even in high school, saying, "So what's the meaning behind this? Is it to do with nature? Is it to do with disability? Is it to do with food?" I never really saw them doing that. Is this something that we should have been doing a long time ago?
I always hesitate with that, because I think that can sort of almost take the fun out of reading, for starters. Mm-hmm. But I think definitely these conversations are important to have, and I think especially about children's literature. And mm-hmm. I'd almost say in academia specifically, as we tend not to talk about it, because as you were saying earlier, that we think that there aren't these meanings to find, it's just a silly children's book. But I don't know, I think there's always something that you can pull out, and whether or not the author meant for it to be there, I think it can still kind of spark these bigger discussions, which are really interesting and I think necessary as well.
And I know there's a colleague of yours in the English department who started off looking at food in literature and how food was related to status in society.
Mm.
So John Brown school days,
mm-hmm.
going to rugby. If you got steak on your table, you're doing well in society. If you got the scraps, you weren't doing so well.
Mm-hmm.
Are you hoping to be able to pull some of this out in some of the literature that you're looking at, but more aligned with the women, young girls, eco, nature, all that sort of thing?
Oh yeah, I mean, class is also, of course, a huge thing in there, and especially back then as well. And I think just moments, it's funny looking back at historical literature as well, because I think there are things that we would find just so odd. Like there's a moment in Layla specifically where there's these little custards on a table that they've been able to make on this wild island because they managed to find goats and nutmeg and all these things, and they have a nurse who can make custard. And Layla's watching this, and she wants to eat it, but she's like, no, I can't. I have to be a good girl. I have to wait till dinner time, and
right.
I must not do this. And even though, you know, she's starving, hungry, but she must be good. And
right.
There's funny little moments that at the time probably wouldn't have seemed very odd. But when I was reading it, I was thinking, this is such a bizarre scene.
Yeah, just eat it.
Just have the custard. You know, you're on an island. It's fine. And I mean, having it there in the first place is odd enough. But
well, for me, it'd be standing around when your mum's baking a cake and you want to lick the bowl, you know, where she's put it into the pan to cook.
Yeah, exactly.
It'd be the same sort of thing. You've got a lot of work to do there, haven't you?
Yes, there's a lot of different threads going on.
And do you think it'll come to fruition, or do you think you're going to have to sort of maybe reduce it even more? You know, not bring in, say, the disability side, just bring in food and nature. And
I think we'll have to see. I think this is probably what my special topics committee is going to have to wrangle with as well.
And that's why you have those people.
Exactly.
Pull it together.
Yeah, make a decision.
It's getting too big. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I wish you the best of luck on that. And I'll be interested to see what comes from it.
Me too.
Yeah, because those stories that you mentioned, I wasn't sure if they were actually the same era, but they clearly are from what you're doing. And they're books that most of us would know. Mm. Admittedly, that was only two. But because I hadn't heard of the Layla one.
No, that's a little earlier as well. But right. Yeah.
Right. But we'll get there. And that's the good thing about storytelling, I think. If there's a good story, people will read it.
That's the hope.
Yes. Which brings me to your book.
Mm.
All right. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Mary just launched her first book. It is The Curse of Eelgrass Bog. Great name. And I looked at the cover of the book. That's a great cover as well. And it's what you kind of would have imagined from just even that title. Now, you just launched this recently.
Yes. No, it came out officially January 2nd.
Yeah, which is brilliant. I mean, I'm just so excited for you. So I just think this is awesome. And if everyone gets a chance, please go and buy the book. And, you know, Mary's got her own website, actually. I'm going to give you a bit of a plug here. You actually write in the name of Mary Aveling.
Aveling. Yes.
And so MaryAveling, all one word, .com. And it tells a little bit about your book and about you and everything. So I do suggest people go and have a look. And particularly if you've got kids, it's done through Penguin Random House.
Yes.
They're the ones that help publish it. So before we go into the book, what made you want to write your own children's stories?
I've always loved writing. And I love that age group. I love the stories that you get for that age group. So I think it was just something that was inevitable in a way.
And you like all this because in it talks, you know, there's dark secrets, there's magic, there's curses. Maybe you should give us a bit of an overview of the book without giving the whole plot away.
Yeah, well, my very quick pitch is it's about a girl. She's 12 years old. Her name is Kess, and she lives in her family's unnatural history museum. And it's kind of going through rough times, so she's trying to find a way to save this museum, potentially by exploring this mysterious, probably cursed bog at the edge of town.
I love it. So did you always like this sort of story yourself, this sort of genre?
Oh, absolutely. You know, like all the dark, spooky, sort of magical. I still love it. And I remember really loving it as a kid. Anything that sort of scared you, but not really. And it was a little bit magical, a little bit strange, all of that. Loved it.
I don't know if I ever did. But yeah, I'd have to go back and look through my books. I grew up with Enid Blyton and all those.
Oh, I like those as well.
Secret Seven, Famous Five, you name it. Or detective stories, which is a kind of a little bit the same here. If you think about the unnatural history and she's trying to get rid of this curse and everything, it's a detective story, isn't it, really?
Mm.
You could probably say that. So you kind of mentioned that you like writing for this group of kids, and here you call it middle grade readers. So, sorry, middle grade is what age group?
9 to 12.
9 to 12.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's still in primary school.
Middle school usually, about there. It depends on how you're cutting up your schools, I suppose.
Bringing in my Australian there, the primary school and things. Okay, so with this, as a writer, but also as a researcher, what was it like going through the publishing process? Because there's hopefully down the track you'll be publishing your papers on your research, but this is totally different. So, and it's very commercial as opposed to an academic one. So how did you find that process, and what did you have to do to even get your book read in the first place?
Yes. I mean, I think one thing that academic publishing and creative publishing have in common is it's very, very slow.
Right.
So the first thing that you have to do, I think once you decide, I want to see my book in bookstores and I want to go like traditionally publishing rather than self-publishing, the first thing you need is an agent. You write your book and then you send it out to agents and...
See who picks it up.
And you wait. And I was lucky that I did find a really brilliant agent at the Andrea Brown Literary Agency. And then she... basically helped me edit. So we were doing that for a while.
Right.
And then we put my book on submission, which is when she submits it to editors and says, would you like to buy this? And my first book did not end up selling.
Oh, no.
So the book that I signed with her with is still shelved. But then the second time around, we were luckier. My book ended up going to auction, which was completely wild, which is when you've got multiple publishers who are both
vying
bidding.
For it?
Yeah. Which was, I was at work that day. It was the weirdest day of my life. But no, and then if you're, you know, the editor ended up buying your book, and for me it was Penguin Random House, an imprint there, and then there's more edits, and then there's proofreading, and there's copy edits, and there's interior design, and then there's marketing, and it does take several years to kind of get it from this Word document on your computer to on the shelves, but somehow it did.
It did.
Yeah.
So from you first putting pen to paper on this particular book to being launched in January, how many years was that?
Oh, I wrote the first chapter during my third year of my undergrad, so 4 years, about that.
I'd say that's pretty good.
It's not too bad. It could have been worse.
I love it. And do you think you'll go back to your original one and sort of change things slightly? Or now, you know, now that you've launched one, you've got a better chance of the first one being picked up as well?
Potentially, we'll see. I've sort of spoken to my agent about that. We did get a 2-book deal, so I have got another one coming out next year, but that they wanted it to be a separate book.
Right.
So it I think at this point it just depends what all of the other people around me say I can do. But I would like to eventually.
That'd be scary. And so you had a book launch here in Kingston.
Yes.
At the Grizzly...
Yes, the Grizzly Grill.
Grizzly Grill.
Yeah.
Which I wouldn't have thought that was a place to have a book launch.
Me neither. No.
But clearly it worked.
It was a great venue. Yeah.
So how did that all happen? How did that work for you?
No, I mean, I was really lucky that the department decided to put this together. So, I mean, really it was all them doing that behind the scenes. And Jessica Trainor is kind of the person who was mostly responsible for that. We have a really great other children's author in the program, Sarah Siang, and her book was amazing. She read there. She does picture books. We got Maggie North from Ottawa, who does rom-coms, to come and read.
Right.
And there was free food, which I think also enticed people to come.
Particularly for students.
But no, it was great. So we had a bit of a discussion about publishing. It's 3 hours long. People showed up.
Nice.
Which was wonderful, yeah.
And is your agent and the publishing house expecting you to go to other places?
Yeah, we do have a couple more signings coming up, especially over March break. A lot of indigos are kind of doing events that they're going to be getting to do. So, but it's exciting.
And would you go to some of the schools themselves, like the middle schools?
I would like to. I've done a couple of readings just virtually on World Reading Aloud Day, but I haven't actually gone physically to a school yet. So that's the next thing I have to tackle.
So I haven't seen the book yet because unfortunately I was away for your launch, but I've got it coming. Is there a lot of pictures in it too? Because
no.
I like books with pictures too. Big writing and pictures.
I would have loved to have had it illustrated, but unfortunately it wasn't. So we've got, you know, the great cover illustration, but on the inside, no pictures.
That's okay.
Words.
And how many pages did you have to write for this?
Printed pages? It's 256 pages.
That's not bad because it would be in big writing, yes?
Yeah, so it's not a long book.
Yeah. I'm so excited for you for doing this. But with that, I mean, you said you started that in your undergrad.
Yes.
And now you're doing your PhD.
Yes.
Which, as we heard earlier in the interview, there's a lot more reading and things that you're going to have to do for that and to get your thoughts together. How do you balance that, your PhD, with one, continuing to promote the book you've just launched and potentially also your next book? Seeing as you've got a 2-book deal, I mean, these publishers, they expect things to be, you know, churned out pretty quickly, don't they? How are you going to balance all of that?
I think that's a question that I'm still learning how to answer. But I think people tend to expect that I have a very rigid schedule. I do 500 words in the morning. But I've actually found that that's that way burnout lies.
Yes.
So I almost just sort of trying to give myself the grace to work on whatever I want to at the time. So sometimes, you know, if you're in a creative mood, I might just work on my book for a few days and then catch up on academic work, and vice versa as well, as sometimes you just can't get that head on. So I do my readings instead then. And I find that usually that's actually been working for me, is that I've been able to balance it out. It does tend to end up okay in the end. But when there's a deadline approaching, either academically or creatively, yes, then you do have to be a little bit more strict, of course. So it's, you know, it is definitely a juggling act.
Does any of your readings that you're doing for your PhD help you, and the topic that you're looking at, has it given you any ideas for a book? You know, when you read someone else's work and look the meaning behind it, is that going to give you some ideas potentially for new books?
I think so. I mean, I think you can kind of find ideas anywhere you look. And I think definitely I like writing about wild spaces, which we discussed earlier. And nature definitely always plays a big part in my setting. So I think being able to think about that more critically is probably helps me. And I think just thinking about childhood and kids and getting into that headspace and thinking, you know, what do they want from books and what do they not want from books as well, has definitely helped.
Would you even consider going out to the schools and ask kids? If it was any sort of book you wanted in the world, what would it be on?
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be really...
Because that's a researcher side of you, right? You know, do an old focus group.
Yeah, no, I mean, at the moment, I've just been sort of borrowing other people's children and, like, sibling friends and, oh, you've got a 12-year-old, what do they think of this? And so, but in a more professional sense, sure, it would be very cool.
Yeah, put everyone in Kingston, watch out. You know, Mary's coming along to ask about your kids and what they're reading.
Oh, no.
And would you ever go into a different genre?
I think I would definitely be interested in doing other types of children's books, like, you know, maybe more contemporary or maybe more fantasy even. And I would definitely think about doing other age categories as well. But I think at the moment, middle grade is really my happy place.
Sure.
And I know that's where my publisher wants me to stay.
Okay, well, there you go. And I guess that's when if you do have some ideas in a different genre, you just write it down and you'll get to that later.
No, I tell my agent, she says, okay, that's cute, now do what you've been paid to do.
Well, you have to really listen to your agent, don't you?
You do, yeah.
Yeah. Luckily, you get on well with your agent.
Yes, no, she's lovely.
Yeah. So she's really helped you understand the process then?
Yeah, she's helped me think about it from a more business point of view, because I think, you know, you do your creative writing undergrad and all of this, but the business side of things is very, very different, and how you negotiate contracts and how sub-rights work. And there's this whole world out there that if you don't know, you don't know, whereas she's been in the biz for a while. So she's really been so valuable at helping me navigate that.
And how about navigating publishing research-wise? Have you had a chance to sort of see how that works? I mean, with your MPhil, did you publish a paper or anything during your MPhil?
I have one essay that's kind of going down the publishing pipe right now, which it's been very different. Basically, there was just a call for papers. I submitted my essay. I was lucky enough to get it in. And then every, you know, 6 months, I'll get an email being like, oh, we just have some changes to make again. So notionally, it's coming out, but it's definitely a lot quieter.
Right.
I'd say it's slower, but that might just be because I don't see what's going on directly with the publisher. The editors do.
And is that something for yourself that you can push? I mean, doing your book, you've got an agent doing it for you.
Mm-hmm.
But in academia, it's really left up to you, isn't it, to find out how it's going?
Yes. Yeah, I think.
Which is frustrating. Yeah, how much do you push?
Exactly. And I think just knowing, you know, what's normal as well is something that you have to figure out, and it can be tricky to know.
So I guess Dr. Cameron can help you on that, of how the academic side works in publishing.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's definitely where the department comes in, is they are the wealth of knowledge there.
Got to rely on them.
You have to.
Yes, exactly. Oh, actually, I didn't ask you, did I? Why are you doing your book under the name of Mary Aveling?
Basically, the short answer is I have got the world's most common name ever, Mary Johnson.
That's a good reason.
It's not easily Googleable. So that was one reason. And then I think the other is I just wanted to keep my academic publishing and my children's books separate, so that people who were trying to search me up wouldn't kind of get the wires crossed there, because the kids probably aren't looking for my academic work and vice versa too.
Well, that makes sense. But where did the word Aveling come from?
Yeah, that one, I basically went on Ancestry.com and I went back back through my family tree until I found a name that was interesting. I was like, ah, oh, that's not Johnson or Jones or any of these, you know, really common English names. So there we
Let's
go.
Bring that one back to the fore.
Exactly. Resurrect it.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, some ancestor's going to be extremely happy.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's well done. Again, we're so proud of you that you're able to get something else out there as well. So good luck with that and good luck with the rest of your PhD. I know there's a lot to do there, but you'll get there.
I hope so. Well, thank you so much for having me on.
It was our pleasure. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. And don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in a Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.